My name is Einat Wilf, and this is the We Should All Be Zionists podcast. Each week, I'll be reading one essay from my latest collection of essays book, We Should All Be Zionists, on issues facing the Jewish people and Israelis today: conflict, peace, religion, politics, past, present, and future. At the end, I'll be joined by columnist Blake Flayton for a discussion on the themes of the essay and how they apply to contemporary Israel and Jewish life. You can purchase your own copy of We Should All Be Zionists anywhere you get your books. Thanks for listening. Let's start. Here is why so many are outraged by Israel's nation-state law. Essay co-authored with Shani Moore for Mosaic Magazine, October 2018. Why all the outrage over Israel's nation-state law? Ask innocently Moshe Koppel and Eugene Kontorovich in Mosaic. The answer is context. Just as Koppel and Kontorovich don't trust Israel's activist and politically biased Supreme Court to interpret properly any law that would enshrine the broad concept of equality, thereby admitting that context matters immensely to them, too, we don't trust this Israeli government and this law's political promoters to interpret Zionism properly. Only one article in the nation-state law truly matters and entails clear political consequences. It is Article 1C. The exercise of the right to national self-determination in the State of Israel is unique to the Jewish people. All other articles flow from this one. In one context, this statement embodies the essence of Zionism and the State of Israel. As a proposal for enshrining the Jewishness of the state in part of the historic land of Israel, with an overwhelming Jewish majority and an unimpeachably democratic regime, the text of the basic law, nation-state, is generally acceptable and reflects the broad consensus of Israel's Jewish Zionist majority. Indeed, nothing about Jewish self-determination is especially unique or uniquely bad. In another context, however, the one envisioned by the law's recent promoters, the law becomes a proposal for entrenching, against any possible democratic challenge, Jewish supremacy in a regime covering the entire land of Israel with a bare 50% Jewish majority, if that. In this context, the law is entirely unacceptable. The text may be the same text, but the context is radically different, and so would be its application. In effect, the declarative import of the law will have moved from affirming one people's liberation to endeavoring to preserve another's subjugation, hence the outrage. Between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea live millions of people who belong broadly to two collectives. Whatever either one thinks about the other, and however invented either one deems the other's nature, they rather violently agree that one is not the other. We ourselves believe, and it is the general global spirit of the last century, that these millions of people have the universal right to be sovereign masters of their fate. They can do so in one polity or more. We, proud members of the Jewish collective, who believe that the purpose of Zionism was not to create a concentrated Jewish minority in a majority Arab Muslim state, prefer that the Jewish people be sovereign in a state of their own, and that the Arab Palestinians exercise sovereignty in a state of their own as well. As the numbers stand, this means partition, dividing the land between the two collectives so that each enjoys a solid and overwhelming majority in a state of its own. This is the only path that enables all the millions of people living between the river and the sea to exercise sovereignty. In this context, the context of partition, Article 1C is perfectly fine. It is even necessary It makes it clear that the very purpose of the painful act of partition is indeed to secure for generations to come the one state in the world where the right to self-determination is unique to the Jewish people, while also adhering to the founding vision of a state based, in the words of its Declaration of Independence, on freedom, justice, and peace as envisaged by the prophets of Israel. But if in the state of Israel, the Jewish collective is uniquely entitled to exercise its right to self-determination as is proper, it follows that the only way the Arab Palestinians, the members of the other collective, can exercise their own universal right to be sovereign in some polity is to have self-determination in a state of their own. This is why one of us, Einat, me, while a member of the Knesset and in the wake of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's 2009 speech at Bar-Ilan University in support of the two-state solution, signed and defended the then-proposed bill in its early round. Indeed, as much as Netanyahu now denies it, his government at the time actively was negotiating partition. And this is also why I continue to defend the same text in the now passed law, on the condition, however, that Israel simultaneously and publicly delineate its final eastern border along a mildly altered 1967 line, and why Shani Moore has likewise defended the text against its more hysterical critics. But this is emphatically not the vision of the law's promoters. They, most notably Justice Minister Ayelet Shaked, Tourism Minister Yariv Levin, and Environment Minister Ze'ev Elkin, are vocal opponents of Arab-Palestinian self-determination. They are on record, frequently and repeatedly, rejecting any division of sovereignty in the land between the river and the sea. Worse, they are known promoters of plans to annex the entire West Bank while permanently denying any path by which the Arab Palestinians living there could ever gain sovereignty and become masters of their fate. Yes, the rejectionists' plans do speak of annexing only 60% of the West Bank, known in the Oslo agreements as Area C, but that is a fraud. There is no such thing as a single Area C. Instead, there are numerous small areas bearing the designation C. In practice, annexing them would mean annexing the entire West Bank while excluding the Arab Palestinians living in dozens of enclaves there from participation in the rights of the annexing power. Calling this autonomy on steroids, as some have done, is no help. Unlike the situation in autonomous regions elsewhere, the inhabitants would still be denied participation in the sovereign polity that determines their fate. In this context, it becomes clear why annexationists like Shaked, Levin, and Elkin cannot abide a guarantee of equality in any basic law. Given the numbers, equal citizenship for all Arab Palestinians living between the river and the sea would spell the end of sovereignty for the Jewish people. For our part, we too, like most Israeli Jews, fear equality under conditions of annexation. Again, however, not because we distrust Israel's activist and politically biased Supreme Court, but because it would spell the literal end of Zionism. The reason that Israeli Jewish annexationists must oppose equality is that their plan can be carried out only through the denial of Arab-Palestinian rights, either to self-determination in a state of their own or as equal citizens in the state of Israel. From this perspective, the constitutional victory heralded by the law's promoters has little to do with the Supreme Court itself. After all, none other than Ayelet Shaked recently told The Atlantic that Israel's conservative camp can no longer whine about being underrepresented in the courts. Instead, it has almost everything to do with the West Bank settler movement, which has gradually redefined Zionism from a movement for the self-determination of the Jewish people in its historic homeland to an affirmation of a theocratically based regime lording it over a non-Jewish majority. There is a name for this, and the name is supremacism, specifically Jewish supremacism. Koppel and Kontorovich might seek to allay our fears and mitigate our resistance by saying, as they have done in conversation, that the issue of annexation is a separate matter, and we should fight for partition regardless of the nation-state law. but we have no intention of legitimizing the explosive legal foundation that the law provides for promoting the annexationist position. The supremacist Zionism is not ours, and the Israel they are busy preparing is so distant from the ideals of Israel's founders that we vow to fight it every step of the way. Hence the outrage.
So, Einat, you just finished a very powerful and again, very relevant piece to our current environment. Here's why so many are outraged by Israel's nation-state law. And the reason why I say it's relevant is because people are still arguing about it, even though this piece was written in 2018. That was when, you know, the original argument was happening. I'll just start off with a personal story. A couple of weeks ago, I went up to the north on a trip, and I met with some Druzim. I met with some Druze Israelis, and the topic of conversation was about the nation-state law, or Chok Aliyum, because the Druze community, since October 7th, has sacrificed a great deal, and before October 7th, but particularly in this war is the reason why the conversation is now, you know, heating up again, is because, you know, they've lost soldiers, and Druze make up a considerable part of the IDF relative to their population, and a considerable part of the police force and prison guards and medical workers and that sort of thing. And it was interesting because I went in with your ideas in my head that the nation state law is, you know, not a crime against humanity, but the one thing that needs to happen is that Israel needs to define its final borders. We need to define who's in and who's out. Therefore, we can have a stable Jewish majority, and where something like a nation state law and democracy are not contradictory, right? That obviously doesn't happen if we go for the Shaked-Levine thing and annexing and the Israeli right plan of annexing the West Bank. But the Druzim in the north didn't say anything about the Palestinians. They talked about how they felt cheated and betrayed by the law. One speaker even said it felt like his family had disowned him, which was very powerful, because there was no equality clause. And then some of them even said that they didn't even want an equality clause for the Palestinians. They want an equality clause specifically for the Druzim as a protected minority, you know? And I guess I'm just like, wow, I'm really confused now, because they didn't even mention the Palestinians or what happens east of the Green Line at all. They are perfectly comfortable with the nation state law as long as there is a clause for equality in there, and as long as their human rights and their privileges are not being stripped away. What do you think about that discrepancy?
So I don't think it's a discrepancy at all. The ability to be very clear on the issue of equality, citizenship, protection for all minorities comes from the understanding of what the border is, who's in and who's out. The reason that the promoters of the law from the annexationist right don't want that is because they want very much to keep alive the option of a single Israeli state that controls the entire area from the river to the sea without any kind of rights for the Palestinians, not national rights and not civil rights. So the ability to have a proper a law that says, okay, I mean, this is the situation, but to be much clearer about it, every citizen in Israel is equal. All minorities are protected. Their forms of life, their languages, religion. To have that in the law, it exists in other elements, but to bring it all together, the reason that it's been opposed is precisely because of the risk it poses to the annexationist vision of Israel. So the Druze bring it from their perspective, but their perspective would be easily addressed if the annexationist vision was not driving at least a large share of the promoters of the law.
Right. And speaking of the annexationist vision, from the river to the sea is obviously in vogue. It has been forever, but specifically during the war. And you see a lot of people on Twitter and a lot of people online in articles, what have you, say it's wrong for Zionists, it's wrong for Israelis to criticize From the River to the Sea as being maximalist or as even being a call for Jewish genocide, because look at the party platform of Likud. I think this has been under my tweets every time I criticize that phrase. Look at the party platform of Likud. Look what the Netanyahu government said when they came into power just recently, that Jews have exclusive national rights between the river and the sea. How is it possible to condemn the Palestinians for a situation in which they have much less power over because of their predicament, which we both agree is a lot their responsibility, and not condemn or not be as adamant as the Jewish, very powerful force that is pushing for not only annexation, but really what some might accurately call an apartheid-like future where a nation-state law rules supreme from the river to the sea? That has already been enacted.
Which is why I condemn both. you know my position.
Yes.
My position is very clear that maximalists on either side are not helping us achieve any useful future. I have written extensively against any Jewish maximalist vision, also in this piece and the previous one about Jewish power and powerlessness, that the one about Jewish power, like the maximalist vision comes from a completely unrealistic vision. And I don't think it's a coincidence that many of the people who possess that that vision are religious, because you need to believe in some outside force in order to ignore reality. So we are a minority in this region. We would best be served in having a state where we are a solid, clear majority. And I really think that the credibility to come out against the maximalist vision of the Palestinians needs to come from a person who also opposes a maximalist vision in Israel. I think in many ways, one of our diplomatic and political tragedies is that we seem to have one or the other. We seem to have people on the right who have maximalist visions and are able to also point out the maximalist visions of the Palestinians. And then we have people on the left who don't have maximalist visions for Israel, and yet they are blind to the maximalist visions of the Palestinians. And the ability to hold both, to not have a maximalist vision for Israel, and to be very clear on the fact that there is a Palestinian maximalist vision, that's at least been, as you know, what I've been trying to do for many years. I will say one thing. On this issue, there has been substantial inter-Jewish, intra-Jewish, intra-Israeli debate. There are political parties in Israel that completely oppose this maximalist vision. There have been Israeli prime ministers who have repeatedly offered partition proposals, negotiated partition. And this has been the simple outcome of the fact that, again, the Jews are a minority in the region. And in order to achieve our desire for a sovereign Jewish state where we enjoy a solid majority, partition is the only way to go. So we've had right-wing governments and left-wing governments who offered always a form of partition. Whereas on the Palestinian side, we actually have no single voice, even a minor voice, that actually says clearly that the Palestinian vision for peace includes partition between an Arab state and a Jewish state. So I would say, even though there are Jewish maximalists in the Israeli political world, I would argue that theological maximalists who would want From the River to the Sea, even if tomorrow all the Palestinians are pro-Zionists, all they want is a state for themselves next to the Jewish state, I would say a tiny minority. Whereas the Palestinian vision has been for a century no Jewish state, and there has been no dissenting voices.
Right, right. It's that discrepancy, if you will. My final question is in regards to two different attitudes that I've seen in regard to the nation state law. The first, and I'll explain both, the first is from Americans who maybe even are Zionists, maybe even believe that the Jews have a right to their ancestral homeland and they have a right to self-determination. But when they see the nation state law, they instantly recoil, because that is not in their modern understanding of what a liberal democratic country should be. They look at the US, they look at Canada, they look at Western Europe, which does not specifically define itself by what population must be in the majority, considering, you know, immigration is a great priority of these different countries. And, you know, they have refugee crisis, which stems from their ability to let people in and to change the fabric of their state from this people to that people. That's the first example of being uncomfortable with any explicitly defined nationality of a state. And the second is sort of related, but sort of not. And it comes from Israelis. It comes from Israelis who, like living in a Jewish state, have no problem with the Megan David on the flag, have no problem with Hatikva, but they say, why is it necessary? You know, Jews in 2023 are, I think, 73% of the Israeli population. Yes, we need an eastern border, and when we do, we'll be a solid Jewish majority and a democracy. But this law is superfluous because it just serves the aspirations of the right. And in practice, it might go toward politically chipping away at the rights of minorities or benefiting Jews, let's say, in regard to property, you know, in building, construction, that sort of thing in different neighborhoods in Israel. And so they're against it for those reasons. What would you say to both of those people in America and also in Israel?
So to those in Israel who oppose it, kind of like, it's all okay, but why say it? Right. And one of the things I told a lot of people is that read the law, because a lot of people projected into that law all the complications they have with the Jewish state and what it means in their imagination. The law is one of the shortest laws on the books. It has very few elements, and most of them are really very basic. And the thing is, it actually nowhere defines what it means to be the Jewish state. That is actually, in a way, one of the most bizarre things for people who think that this is a law that is very limiting. It actually says nothing about what it means to be the Jewish state. It's just said that Israel's the Jewish state.
Do you think that was on purpose?
Of course, because, you know, I have this talk that I give about what it means to be the Jewish state, and I make the claim that the Jewish state is the one state in the world where we argue about what it means to be the Jewish state. In the nature of Israel, we've never defined what it means to be the Jewish state, because the very essence of Israeli democracy and its Jewishness was about the argumentation and the interpretation of what it meant to be the Jewish state. So the law, as a result, actually says nothing except the Hebrew language and the flag and the Hatikva. And that's about the amount of Jewishness that exists in the law. So for a lot of people who say, why say it, it becomes this kind of almost weird debate. Well, why not say it? If you feel so uncomfortable saying it, then clearly you have a problem. So that was kind of the debate that people had about it. And I even had friends who said, you know, I wasn't in support of the law. I thought it was superfluous. But then when I saw how many people opposed it, I decided to defend it, because clearly people didn't have a problem with the law. They had a problem with Israel asserting itself as a Jewish state. So given that my tendency is always to be on the side of clarity, leaning in, being assertive, I tend to lean in, again, given the question of the border and equality, in favor of saying, we're the Jewish state. There's nothing to apologize for, and we're not running away from that. In many ways, this is why we exist. Otherwise, why bother, right? This is, as they say, the raison d'être. This is our reason for being. And this goes to your first question. One of the biggest challenges I've had over the years is explaining nation states to Americans. Americans are under the illusion that their form of statehood is the norm. And I always have to tell them that they're the exception rather than the rule. And even the idea that America is this neutral civic idea of nationalism, even that, I think, is part of the crisis in America right now, of the deep debate. America is en route to being the first major multi-ethnic democracy in the world. So it is actually not the norm. So many countries that say, you talked about European and refugees, they have minorities that are not Christian or historically Christian, secularized Christian, in much lower numbers than Israel. And they already are suffering the rise of right-wing governments. And so the notion that somehow all states in the world have figured out this kind of multi-ethnic, multinational civic identity, that's not true. And if anything, it's exactly the opposite. The rise of democracy, the expansion of democracy, the replacement of empires by democratic states was enabled by the idea of the nation. Because the idea of one person, one vote is still a very radical idea. People don't realize how recent and how radical it is. And the only way that people were willing to live in one person, one vote political entities is because they felt they could trust each other. And the basis of trust was generally nation, the common language, common history, common background religion, common ethnicity. And people said, okay, with people who generally I have a level of historical trust, I can live in a political democratic entity where we are all equally powerful. America, whenever it had to extend the one person, one vote to people who did not look like the original Americans, it went to war. People think it was like some easy peasy. No. So Israel, with having a nation state and a democracy, that's actually the norm. But you're absolutely right. To get Americans to understand that the idea of a nation and the idea of democracy are actually intimately linked is something that I have to spend typically a lot of time explaining.
And I'm sure we'll spend a lot of time explaining it in future episodes because it is a very interesting, very deep topic that I think is on a lot of people's minds and intrinsically really troubles a lot of self-described liberals. Like
yes.
You mentioned the rise of the far right in places where, you know, we think a constitutional democracy or a pluralistic democracy is taken for granted. And no, that's not exactly true. And you talk about throughout history where every time that there was clashes between nations and peoples, even the most explicit expressions of democratic systems have cracked. And I think we've only begun to see that in the Western world. So thank you so much, Einat.
Really appreciate
the conversation.
מתעורר, מה שהוא מתעורר.